Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning and welcome to Africa Link. It is Thursday morning, the 5th of May, and I'm Jane Ayeka Kumet in Bonn, Germany. In today's edition, Kenyan police swat anthrax terror attack planned by medical students linked to the so-called Islamic State. But how credible is their claim? We hear from an expert.
The only information is from the Kenyan authorities, who have proven to be a highly unreliable source over the past few years, particularly on security issues.
And UN urges South Sudan's new government to foster real peace.
The guns simply must be silent. We need to address the urgent humanitarian situation in South Sudan. The transitional government can help to ensure the free movement of humanitarian assistance, including ensuring that roadblocks do not prevent vital supplies from reaching people in need.
All that, plus learning by ear drama series Crime Fighters, coming up shortly.
Top story.
Kenyan police are still holding two extremists suspected of having been planning a biological attack on Kenya and recruiting university students to join the so-called Islamic State. Muhammad Abid Ali, a medical intern, was arrested on Friday, while his wife, also a medical student in Uganda, was arrested in Kampala. Two of Ali's alleged accomplices, Ahmed Hish and Farah Dagane, also medical interns, have since gone into hiding, and police are offering a reward of $20,000 for information leading to their arrest. The suspects are said to have been planning a large-scale attack akin to the 2013 Westgate Mall attack. DW's James Manula has been telling me what is known about the suspects and their families.
The suspects are believed to be students at a hospital in eastern Kenya, and they are being detained under a court order that they be kept by police for investigations. One of them was arrested in Uganda. The family background is rather sketchy, but they are believed to have ties with people connected to Islamic State that the government believes is plotting a biological attack on the country, and they have links in Libya and Syria as well. And apart from the information that the kind of attack was to be equated to the one that was carried at the Westgate Mall in September 2013, in which 67 people died. So they were yet to do that.
Do we know the origin of these people?
They are believed to be Somalis, but what the government has not specified is whether they had been to Somalia or they have been in Kenya and for how long. But they are of Somali origin.
How did the police get hold of them?
Through information that they received from informed sources. These days, the Kenyan government, since it was attacked during the Westgate and the Garissa University, you know, it's also in eastern Kenya, has been very alert, well-informed, and promptly acts on the information it gets.
Some activists seem to be doubting the narrative coming from the police. What are Kenyans saying about this?
That one, the Interior Minister Nkaiseri has always said that there is nothing taking place that the human rights groups are accusing police of doing. So it has been negative on the side of the state, and it has remained negative because no evidence has been adduced either in court or at police stations or independently to prove that indeed what you have just stated is taking place.
James Shimanyola in Nairobi. Some rights activists have accused the Kenyan police of killing suspects. They claim that the police are now using this as a cover-up after the medical students disappeared. I've been speaking to Jesper Carlin, an intelligence analyst at Risk Advisory, and started by asking him if indeed the suspects had the ability to transform anthrax into a weapon of terror, considering their qualifications.
This is something that is very difficult for them to do, whether a medical intern, well, previously a university in Uganda and currently a rural hospital in Kenya, would have access to materials and the expert to weaponize anthrax is a completely different matter. Although there may have been some intent, perhaps, on their part, whether they have that capability is something that's very unclear and would be highly surprising for a medical intern at a rural hospital to have that.
Just in line with what you're saying, you seem to be questioning the ability of these medical intern students, so to say. There have also been some complaints from the so-called rights activists who actually claim that the police is only using this scenario as a disguise because the medical students actually disappeared, and the Kenyan police has been accused of being responsible for some of the disappearances. What do you have to say about that?
Over the past years, there's a pretty well-established track record with the Kenyan police to kill suspects in terrorism or even on crime and these sorts of issues. So, I mean, it wouldn't be surprising, but whether that's the case in this particular instance, it's impossible to say with the information we currently have.
Assuming that the suspects were actually trying to use this substance as a weapon of terror, do you think that the extremists are now changing their terror tactics?
I think that's very difficult to say. I mean, with the information we have at the moment, we can't really determine whether that was something they were planning to do, able to do. But looking at a group in someone like Kenya that is, or even individuals that are planning to mount an attack, their access to weapons, to guns, is pretty easy in a place like Kenya. So an attack like that's much easier to carry out and much easier to have a larger impact in something in terms of fatalities and casualties than much more complicated type of attacks, such as using anthrax.
And finally, can we look at this as a purely Kenyan case, or does it attract international attention?
Well, I think it's certainly interesting that we haven't really seen any attack in Kenya in a couple of years now, outside of the northeast, that is. And of course, it's of interest internationally. I mean, Kenya has, it's one of the most important economies in the region. There's a huge international presence in places like Nairobi. So yes, of course, it's relevant on that front. It's also relevant on what these sorts of indications mean for groups such as Al-Shabaab, their links in wider networks. But I think this is still quite a small, isolated case that we still know very little about. The only information is from the Kenyan authorities, who have proven to be a highly unreliable source over the past few years, particularly on security issues.
I was speaking to Jesper Carlin in London.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
Sometimes bad things lead to good things or even conflict resolution. Well, after a long period of poor relations due to a dispute over the oil-rich Bakassi Peninsula Island, Nigeria and Cameroon are once again on talking terms. Their reunion is steered by a need for joint effort to fight terrorism in the region. While on a two-day state visit in Nigeria, Cameroonian President Paul Biya and Nigeria's Muhammadu Buhari signed a series of agreements aimed at strengthening security and economy on the Lake Chad Basin. From Abuja, Musa Ubali reports.
The visit, first of its kind in over two decades and a half, mostly focused on the Boko Haram insurgency as well as economic cooperation. Several agreements on military cooperation and trade were signed by the two leaders, amongst them uniting in fighting Boko Haram insurgency at all costs. Nigerian President Muhammad Buhari applauded Cameroon's contribution and other Lake Chad Basin Commission countries in the fight against Boko Haram.
On the security aspect, I remain grateful to the Lake Chad Basin Commission because on my arrival, we found out some of the efforts made and we built on it, especially the multinational joint task force. And certainly we have said enough about the performances for both our military. And we thank you. We thank other members of the multinational joint task force for occasionally coming into our own territory and securing it for us from Boko Haram terrorists.
Beyond the task of securing their borders, Cameroon and Nigeria also agreed to resume the demarcation of the 1,500-kilometer long contested border between the two countries. The visit, however, sounds as an end to decades-long animosity and a new chapter of economic cooperation, according to Paul Biya, the visiting Cameroonian president.
Bien évidemment, nous sommes également conscients We agreed, in as much as the security issues are important and we should focus on them, we also understood the need to focus on the economic issues so that we re-establish livelihoods and revamp local economies in areas affected by Boko Haram crisis. We also touched on climate change and its consequences on our region and Africa in general.
President Biya's last official state visit to Nigeria was way back in 1991.
Musa Ubale in Abuja. The UN has called on South Sudan's newly formed Transitional Government of National Unity to hastily implement the peace agreement. The UN Special Representative of the Secretary General in South Sudan, Helen Margaret Lois, told journalists in Juba that the international community was eagerly waiting to see a functional government leading to restoration of total peace in the country. Wake Simon Wudu reports from the capital, Juba.
Head of the United Nations mission to South Sudan, Helen Margaret Lois, urges President Salva Kiir and First Deputy President Riek Machar to urgently implement the rest of the peace agreement signed in Addis Ababa.
It's now incumbent on the transitional government to move with speed to complete the establishment of all the transitional institutions articulated in the peace agreement.
Lois says the United Nations wants to see a quick integration of a joint police force. Under the peace agreement, some of Machar's security forces were supposed to be integrated into the National Police Force. Since Machar returned to office, this has not happened yet. Meanwhile, there are still violence in some parts of the country. Lois again.
The guns simply must be silent. We need to address the urgent humanitarian situation in South Sudan. The transitional government can help to ensure the free movement of humanitarian assistance, including ensuring that roadblocks do not prevent vital supplies from reaching people in need.
The UN diplomat also says Kiir and Machar need to fix the controversial formation of 28 new states. Last November, Kiir divided the country's 10 states into 28. Machar, then a rebel leader, rejected the formation. Lois also says the UN does not recognize Kiir's 28 states. This issue and security arrangements concerns are some of the critical issues the transitional government needs to urgently address to get further international backing. South Sudanese civil society activists have voiced concerns over these unresolved issues. Edmond Yakani is the director of the Community Empowerment for Progress organization in South Sudan.
At national level, please complete the parliamentarian process to form the national parliament. And also we have independent commissions, institutions. So we feel that those independent commissions and institutions at national level requires a speedy completion. But also besides that, we have transitional government at the state level. So we're also calling them that they need to complete the transitional governments at state level, both legislative and executive, and including independent commissions and institutions. So that's the call we're calling.
Yakani thinks without quick action on the remaining outstanding issues, it may derail the full implementation of the peace agreement.
Wake Simon Wudu in Juba. Up next is Crime Fighters.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
A very warm welcome to our series, Crime Fighters, Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill, by Mukoma Wangugi. We're on the third episode, called At the Precipice. After 21-year-old Peter died of drug overdose, Peter's houseboy Fuma led the detectives to the bar, the lounge. Here they found a huge quantity of illegal and counterfeit medicines. It appeared that the owner of the bar was Dr. Kamkuta, the president's personal doctor. But he told the detectives they needed to talk to his brother Malinya, as he actually runs the lounge.
The old saying that an apple doesn't fall far from the tree is a lie. Here we have two apples from the same tree. One, perfectly ripe, falls, bounces into the shade and becomes Dr. Kamkuta. The other, a rotten apple, falls, rolls down the hill and becomes Malinya. Their fates are linked by the bonds of brotherhood. But it seems that whatever Kamkuta does to try and help Malinya, Malinya's rottenness still shows through. After we'd interviewed Dr. Kamkuta, Salamisha and I picked up our colleague Chokbank and went to Malinya's house.
I don't think there's anyone home.
Yeah, probably you're right.
I'll try the back.
Goodness, get down!
I kicked in the door and entered with my gun drawn, Chokbank and Salamisha behind me. A man was lying on the floor in front of a large glass window. In the glass was a small hole, more like a spider's web, where the bullet had come through. Whoever had shot him was good and dangerous.
Cover me!
I got you. Chokbank, check the window.
The window's clear.
Are you Malinya?
Yes. Please, don't kill me. I don't want to die.
We're not with them. We're detectives. We've come to ask you a few questions about the lounge.
Kalumba, press some cloth on the wound or he'll bleed to death.
Malinya, do you know who did this?
No. For God's sake, get me some help.
It is true. You don't look too good, man. Tell us the truth and we'll call you an ambulance.
Ambulance? I'll be dead long before.
Okay. We'll drive you to a hospital ourselves if you tell us what we want to know.
Take me to my brother.
He's going to die on us. If we lose him, we'll be right back where we started.
Fine. Get him to the car. We'll persuade him to talk to us later.
Malinya screamed in pain all the way to the hospital. Salamisha tried to comfort him. So did Chokbank in his way. He threatened Malinya that he'd better make it, otherwise they'd meet again on the other side and it'd really make him sorry. When we finally got to the hospital, they paged Dr. Kamkuta, who came immediately to take care of his brother. That's when my phone rang. The coroner. Chokbank stayed at the hospital to question Malinya as soon as he came round, while Salamisha and I went to the morgue. It was always quite something going to see Ndau. He was unlike any other coroner I've ever seen. Very tall, muscular, always wore a suit. The smell in his workplace was so sterile, so devoid of humanity, it felt like death itself. If Kamkuta was good at saving lives, Ndau was good at dissecting death. The only thing that seemed out of character was that he liked a good laugh.
Ah, there you are, my friends. I'd like to say I've missed you, but I don't suppose my feelings are reciprocated, are they? The less you see of me, the better, right? What is it you call me? Huh? The devil's accountant, huh?
But it's a compliment, Ndau. It means you wield a kind of power.
True, Salamisha. Yet you don't wish to be counted by me, do you?
Well, no, not yet. What have you got for us, Ndau?
Peter was poisoned, cleverly poisoned, over a long period of time. I'd say 2 weeks, a month.
Are you going to tell us how?
Cyanide. In pill form. Cyanide packaged to look like something else and mixed in with his regular capsules. He had a heart defect. He had a prescription for Bimax and we found traces of that in his blood. But it's very rarely lethal, even when taken in large amounts. And we didn't find it in high doses. But the cyanide. Now, that's what killed him.
Hold on. Explain this again. You're saying he was poisoned slowly, over time?
You realize how easy that is? This country is awash with illegal medications. Millions of people buy them because the medications the doctors prescribe are simply too expensive.
But Peter comes from a very rich family.
Look, I'm no detective. That beats your job. The point is that whoever killed him was working with people who make knockoff meds. Someone with medical knowledge and the ability to make cyanide capsules. Someone who also had access to Peter's heart medication.
So we're looking for a cold-blooded, patient, methodical killer or killers.
And they are clever. Very clever.
How cruel. Every time Peter reached for his heart medication, he was actually killing himself.
Thanks, Doc. Good work as always. We are going to Peter's funeral this afternoon.
I wish him bon voyage. But don't thank me yet, Kalumba. I hope you realize you're dealing with some very dangerous people.
Peter's funeral was attended by the who's who of Kitagu People's Republic, all the way from President Gomobo to ministers, judges, celebrities, philanthropists, and those whose claim to fame was simply being filthy rich like Peter's parents. Killers like to attend their victims' funerals, sometimes out of perverse pleasure and satisfaction, but more often because they can't quite believe their victim is really dead. I knew my killer was here somewhere.
It was a classy funeral with expensive wine and cheese, and Chokbank was taking full advantage of the catering. By the late afternoon, he was drunk and still drinking.
The Lord works in mysterious ways. He has taken Peter, and now his parents must mourn him. Surely it should be the other way around. Surely the natural way of things is for children to mourn their parents.
Yeah.
But we know that with the Lord, there are no accidents or mistakes. He has called Peter home for a reason.
If you say so, preacher.
Kalumba, we'd better go and offer our condolences. Chokbank should stay here and try to look sober.
Okay, Salamisha. Let's make ourselves visible. Maybe someone will get nervous and slip up. Chokbank.
Yes, sir.
We'll be right back, okay?
Okay. Preacher man.
Yes?
You preach a good game. Do you often go preaching at the lounge?
One must preach in the den of sin.
Ah. So Baba Peter's house is a den of sin, is it?
Look around. Look at all the powerful sinners here, shedding crocodile tears. This is the greatest den of sin.
You know who killed the boy?
You know how to get the top? You start at the bottom. The top is right here. But to get to him or them, you have to hit the streets, the dens of sin. What I've heard through the good Lord is that it was a healer. You know, the heathens, the non-Christians, the ones who practice African bush medicine.
Names. Why don't you give us some names?
Indeed, the Lord had been very kind. A name does come to mind.
Does the preacher really have a hot tip for the detectives? Find out next time. In the meantime, feel free to visit our website, dw.com/crimefighters, and join the discussion on Facebook. Bye for now. Well, it's always nice to learn by hearing. Tune in again on Sunday for the next episode of Crime Fighters.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/AfricaLink. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter. dw.com/AfricaLink.
Now here is a recap of our main stories. Kenyan police have thwarted an anthrax terror attack planned by medical students linked to the so-called Islamic State. And in Sudan, the UN has called on the newly formed government of national unity to foster peace in the country. We've also been hearing how the fight against Boko Haram is uniting West African countries, with Nigeria and Cameroon signing agreements on military cooperation. That's all for today. Remember, we welcome your opinion on this program. Please send us your comment via text message to country code 49160 957-59510. You can also send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to AfricaLink DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Thank you for listening. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kimet saying have a nice day.